Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 196 and we're covering the movement towards self-government and the first Cape Constitution, which included what's known as a qualified franchise. A trend had been sweeping British colonies by the mid-19th century, where the coming Commonwealth was intent on running their own affairs on a country-by-country basis. The first self-governing colony of the British Empire, you could say, was Massachusetts in 1630, showing how long the Americans had been tugging at the British leash before they began their War of Independence. But to be strictly accurate, it was the province of Canada in 1841, and all colonies of British North America became self-governing between 1848 and 1855, except Vancouver Island. Australia is a bit more complex. There were six settler colonies, which each achieved self-governing status over quite a long period, between 1852 and 1901. Well, seven, if you include New Zealand. Sorry to the Kiwis, the English system kind of lumped Australasia together. There'd been a growing tension between the mother country with its erratic political system and the colonies. The plethora of politics that blew back and forth courtesy of the British voter was head-spinning. But by 1850, the British bureaucracy began to gain prominence, and in the halls of power it was whispered that public jobs were going to be based on merit rather than patronage. As this liberalisation of the system back home began to shake the dusty, cobweb-strewn hallways of ancient Britain, the philosophy drifted outwards like an informed mist towards the distant colonies. The problem for the colonists was the liberals wanted black people to have rights. The conservatives vacillated. Settlers, almost to a man, preferred indigenous people of the colonised territories to avail themselves as labour without recourse to the same rights as themselves. The British reforms of 1853 and 54 were introduced with a kind of shock treatment to the former patrons, the deployed cadres, to mix up the lexicon a little. The former patrons were replaced by a system of public examinations. The meritocracy was a very particular sort, based on classically educated Englishmen of Oxford and Cambridge. The ideology of merit was employed to produce a particular kind of ruling elite. In the midst of this ideological meritocracy revolution, Cape Colony residents were mobilising in the general direction of self-government. By the late 1840s, enthusiasts in the Cape had demanded free and popular institutions unfettered by British political interference. That was a bit much, seeing that many of the goings-on in the Cape were underwritten by the British taxpayer. Various British governments had tried to cut the purse strings, but one war after another had led to a distant dependency. You'll remember last episode we met new Cape Attorney General William Porter, an Irish Democrat who wanted to extend the rights afforded white colonists to all who lived in the Cape. He arrived in Cape Town in 1839 and was acutely aware of the changing winds back home when it came to bureaucracy. Confounding a quick solution to the debate about who should be allowed to vote was the fact that officials in the Cape just couldn't get along. Chief Justice Wilde wanted to have a seat on the proposed lower house of a new Cape legislature, even though he was a technocrat. Porter himself hankered after a seat in the House of Assembly and proposed as Attorney General that officials should be allowed to stand for election without being held responsible to Parliament for their official acts. A form of self-deployed cadre, if you like. Porter believed he could be both a member of this new Cape Parliament and an Attorney General. But he also had a very radical view of democracy, believing that the franchise should be the right of every man, no matter what his income or capex. No woman, however. Ah well, you have to start somewhere. So Porter believed that black, coloured and white men should have the vote, but no woman. Everyone agreed, however, that the concept of a franchise system was important, and the franchise should be low enough so that all had a kind of a shot of being allowed to vote, except women. Disallowing coloureds the vote had been the major reason at least two colonial secretaries had delayed self-government in South Africa. In Britain, there were schools of thought, and there were two. One called the Manchester School favoured self-government because they believed free trade meant the possession of colonies was rendered unnecessary. A second school was dominated by Gibbon Wakefield, who said self-government would lead to the retention of empire. What this entailed back in the day was that everyone who had something of value, like land, could cast a ballot, but the vote wasn't an automatic franchise to everyone over the age of 18 who was a citizen as it is today. It was a limited franchise so that more whites could vote than coloureds and blacks. This was known as the Cape Qualified Franchise. The ideology of utilitarianism mixed with evangelicalism was characteristic of a new order. However, it was tempered by fear. There were two factions debating this in southern Africa in 1850 through 1853. One faction sought a narrowly based electorate to be achieved by high property qualification, and the other a widely based electorate to be achieved by a low property qualification. What this translated into was the idea that a minority of black and coloured people in the Cape could vote, but only those who had some sort of collateral. There was a bar over which people had to jump to vote, and the bar was weighted towards the settlers. The two schools were also based in language to some extent, with the high qualification folks, the English, and the low qualification folks, the Dutch, future Afrikaans. But there were others who sided with both. Irishman Porter sent a first draft of a future Cape Constitution to the Colonial Secretary in England in 1850. The draft was returned with the approval of the Privy Council, including notes that the upper house should be elective and not nominated, and that officials were not allowed to stand for election to the Assembly. There went Porter's self-deployed cadre plan, at least for now. A representative council was to be installed, and then Harry Smith, who was still governor at that stage, invited the municipal councils and divisional road boards to put forward names for his consideration. Here again is the link between the road boards and political power I mentioned a while back. This makes sense. The infrastructure growing, that was road networks around South Africa, required oodles of cash and lashings of labour. The road boards built bridges and fords across rivers and cut wagon trails. They hammered and then blasted the original mountain passes that we use today. Every mountain road, you see, was built in blood, sweat and gunpowder, then nitroglycerine. The road board officials are almost mythological. They are so profoundly important in South Africa's growth story. This representative council had to have names, and those chosen were at the top of everyone's list. Respected lawyers C. Brandt, John Webber, the editor and prime mover, and shaker behind self-government, F.W. Reitz, who was the father of the future Free State president, as well as Andries Stockenstrom, and the only Easterner and businessman, William Kok. At the age of 27, William Kok had led a party of 91 British settlers who landed from the Weymouth at Algoa Bay in May 1820. With his party, he travelled by ox wagon to their location on the Rifaan River, a few miles east of the Cowrie River in the Eastern Cape, where he erected a temporary home for his wife and children and enclosed a piece of land for cultivation. His farm failed, so he turned to transporting stock instead and became rich, supplying the British Army through its various frontier wars in the Eastern Cape. Then, although he was 12th on the list, Robert Godlinton was added because he supported the governor. He was the second Easterner. Cape officials were aware of the bloody arguments between the Stockenstrom supporters and the Godlinton supporters. When then Governor Smith added Godlinton, a few eyebrows were raised because the aggressive Grahamstonian had received the fewest votes of all. But he was a populist, and Smith didn't want some misinformed settler rocking up brandishing his extensive paunch and musket, claiming votes had been stolen. These four, Reitz, Brandt, Fairburn and Kok, arrived having agreed to work together as a party and to discuss nothing but the Constitution. The odd man out was the fifth, Godlinton, and he was hostile, and they were hostile to him. The four popular members and the one populist agreed that the qualifications necessary for membership of this upper house must be reduced and that the lower house must be given full control of the finances. In other words, they wanted full responsible government. The four members then disagreed and marched out together without Stockenstrom, when he read out what was called his 11 reasons for dissent. This meant there was no longer a quorum. New nominees were appointed to the council. All were English-speaking now. Two were wealthy Cape Town merchants. A third was a retired businessman, and the fourth, a large landed proprietor in the Western Cape. Then the Eighth Frontier War broke out, and constitutional developments were stalled. This led to Brandt, Reitz, Kok and Godlinton being approached by the Cape Town municipality to draft a rival constitution, When this was taken to London by Fabian, it was rejected, but he was trailed by André Stockenstrom, who arrived in Downing Street to complain. British officials are now facing squabbling colonists in London from South Africa, so both sides were fobbed off. With the colonists indulging in handbags at six paces, Irishman William Porter thought he'd have a go himself and drew up what is known as the Attorney General's Draft, which became the basis of the future Cape Constitution of 1853, and in a contorted kind of way, part of our modern constitution. This draft was still being debated as the Eighth Frontier War began, and as that war developed, so too did the constitution. Each successive update seemed to change the council at the Cape, with John Montagu, who was a conservative, stuffing vacancies on the council with men who followed his way of thinking, known as the Westerners, as in Western Cape, as opposed to the Easterners, who were from British Kaffraria, the future Eastern Cape, East versus West, the other Makaza War, Coat, Yabanda. At this moment in February 1852, the Liberal government of Russell fell and the Tories re-entered the political stage. Lieutenant General George Cathcart arrived, replacing interim Governor Montagu, who himself had replaced fired Governor Smith. In 1852, Henry Pelham Clinton, the 5th Duke of Newcastle, was inducted as the Secretary of State for War and the Colonies, no relation to Bull. The Privy Council goes back to the earliest days of the English monarchy, when it comprised those appointed by the King or Queen to advise matters of state. The term privy, from the French privé, signifies private or secret. Consequently, a Privy Council existed as a kind of group of ruling monarch's most trusted court advisers. So the Privy Council ruled that the Cape would finally get its parliament. The Legislative Council would have a life of 10 years and was elective, with 8 members from the Western Cape, 7 from the Eastern Cape. 4 members in each province would have to retire every 5 years to rotate the power more effectively. The House of Assembly was the lower tier, made up of 42 members, with the Western Cape enjoying a majority of 2, and this assembly sat for 5 years. It was the governor's job to summon both the Legislative Council and the House of Assembly at any place he chose to name. There were no Houses of Parliament at this stage. And that was as far as autonomy went. This was not self-government. There was no separation of powers. Still, this document was momentous. There was a comparatively low franchise, although not as low as William Porter wanted. The introduction to this 1853 constitution exclaims, "All Her Majesty's subjects, without distinction of class or colour, should be united by one bond of loyalty and a common interest." Those who would be legislative councillors had to be at least 30 years old, possessing £2,000 worth of land or £4,000 in movables. This was an extremely high bar, and even the settler popular members disagreed with it. The Chief Justice presided over the council. Cape Town itself had 4 seats, and then 2 each of the 9 Western Divisions. Grahamstown had 2 seats, and 2 each in their 9 Eastern Divisions. Thus, the Western Cape had a slim majority of 2. The powers of Parliament were rigidly restricted, much to William Porter's disgust, and both houses ended up competing for control over the finance, the money bills, the budget, the moolah. But both houses agreed on one fundamental principle. The first bill they passed was the Freedom of Speech Bill, following which they settled down to business. The franchise was carefully designed to allow for some coloured and black voters, but not too many. The test was you had to occupy for 12 months or more a premises worth £25 a year, or you had to earn a salary of £50, or with board and lodging, £25. Porter the Irishman wanted that reduced to £10. He failed. This franchise limitation was to remain unchanged between 1853 and 1892, when it was actually raised and an education test was added just to keep out black merchants, who had become quite a powerful class by then. Another little aside, the word franchise comes from the French verb franchir, which means to give liberty to. It's derived from the adjective franc, which means free. The word franc comes from the Latin name for the Franks, a West Germanic people who settled in Gaul. The Franks believed in the rights of the individual over the rights of the state. Interesting. Well, it makes sense then, because Robert Godlinton, who'd been part of this first phase, as an Easterner, he was unhappy about how the councils had been constructed, the power leaning towards Cape Town. He popped up during the first session of the Legislative Council with what he called his 1820 programme. This included full separation for the South Africans, a franchise that ensured that no black person could vote, a vagrancy law, a modified commander system, increased tariffs, and a cutback in the public service. Standing back from this, you can read quite a bit of modern politics in Godlinton's 1820 program. More power to law and order, harder for non-whites to get to polling stations, more tariffs to protect local producers, slashing the size of government, and getting rid of all those vagrants, i.e. immigrants. At least Godlinton's tan was natural. It was also natural that the Easterners should chafe. All those urbane Capetonians and the self-righteous liberalism, growled the Grahamstonians. They had no idea how tough it was on the frontier. The Westerners were sitting in their tea houses and coffee shops, while the Easterners faced the full might of the Amaxhosa in the Eighth Frontier War. Harumph! Went the Easterners' op-eds. Speaking of the war, it was about to come to an end, burning itself out, so to speak. When Lieutenant Colonel Cathcart had arrived in the Eastern Cape, his initial strategy to end the war was to do what other British commanders had done, start building fortified posts. Cathcart went further. These weren't posts, he said. These were castles. A titter echoed across the room. Castles? One was built above the deadly Waterkloof where Macoma liked to hide, another on the Grahamstown to King Williamstown Road, which was being menaced by Siolo. Cathcart's progress was being closely monitored by Lieutenant Colonel Eyre, who by now had become disgusted and asked for sick leave, thus heading to the tea and coffee houses of Cape Town. He wasn't alone. Another veteran of the war, Hugh Robinson of the 43rd Regiment, was enraged when he witnessed Cathcart galloping, or what he called scampering about, with his escort of cavalry, like a crazy fancy dress. They all wore full dress uniforms with their swords on. The governor had also donned hip-high leather riding boots, a kind of S&M-style tight leather that earned him the sarcastic nickname of Boots Cathcart. Some said he slept in them. Perhaps he slept with them. The mind boggles. There was no security anywhere along the frontier, or even inside British Kaffraria. The Amaxhosa and Khoikhoi rebels were raiding at will, even as far as Algoa Bay. The Khoikhoi were proving to be extremely difficult adversaries, even as Amaxhosa resistance began to weaken. That weakening began within. Chief Toise, who was Amantlambi Chief Mphala's cousin, was hated by the Amaxhosa. As we've heard, throughout the clashes between British and Amaxhosa, there were always Xhosa prepared to do a deal, a weak link inside the warrior bands, who recognised that they could use information to feather their own nests. Before we judge, let's just calm down a bit and recognise that Pato of the Qunuqwebe had been consorting with the British for years. He'd been a close ally of the British in previous wars. He'd only recently flipped sides. Toise, however, was a special case. That's because he didn't just offer to support the British or spy on the Amaxhosa. He offered to trap Chief Sandile, the Amanxika paramount chief, on the British behalf. For many, that took self-serving decision-making a little too far. The Amanxika wanted Toise to atone. Willem Eithalder, the former Cape Mounted Rifles rebel, offered to catch Toise before he could do further damage. In May 1852, he was caught inside a hut and then told that Sandile was going to pitch up the following day to conduct the summary execution. They stripped Toise's wife naked, trashed his hut, then drove off his horses and cattle to add injury to insult. This was an extremely unusual act for the Amaxhosa to publicly humiliate. A chief of the house of the Rarabe was unheard of. Sandile was indeed on his way. He sent his counselors and brother Anta ahead to receive the prisoner. But then a strange thing happened. The Khoikhoi objected to Toise being put to death without a trial. There was no such thing as a trial in traditional Amaxhosa culture. So before Sandile arrived, Eithalder released Toise, sending him off to Cathcart carrying a letter that began with the line, "My esteemed Sir General," then went on to lambaste the British for killing women and children. The Khoikhoi rebels were deploying a kind of European-style rebellion culture, where they mixed their traditions with that of the colonials and the Amaxhosa in their own style, if you like. There was much talk at this time about a Khoikhoi Republic, and the ongoing reports about the Cape trying to achieve self-government had resonated far further afield than it appeared. Sandile recognised this independent spirit too and told his councillors that the Khoikhoi were not fighting the Amaxhosa war, they were fighting their own war. Suddenly, The British appeared to be fighting a war on two fronts they didn't even know about. Like all British commanders before him, Cathcart actually blamed everything on the main Amakhosa paramount chief, who lived across the Kai River, Swahili, of the Amakhaleka. A large column was sent over the river, Swahili withdrew, and like previous occasions, the British seized a vast quantity of cattle and sheep. Then they attacked the Khosa in the Waterkloof ridges of the Amatullahs, with the Lieutenant Colonel Eyre back from his short R&R in the Cape. What followed was more extreme carnage. It was vicious, this swan song of the 8th Frontier War, because Eyre's 73rd Regiment had seen their own men tortured to death by the Amakhosa, and they therefore reciprocated. Rebel Khoi Khoi taken prisoner were hanged without trial, so too Khosa warriors, their corpses left dangling in the trees as a warning. British mercenaries had been hired. One man was Captain Stephen Bartlett Lakeman. He had his own private army called the Waterkloof Rangers. His men made a name for themselves, killing everything and everyone in their path. Lakeman would leave the Cape for the Crimea, where he fought with the Ottomans against the Russians, eventually becoming a pasha, almost a governor-level rank, then lived in Bucharest and Romania. He was even mentioned in a Thabo Mbeki speech in 2004, but his story is for another time. A kind of madness had descended in the bush of the Amatola ravines, with members of Lakeman's army boiling cadavers to render the skeletons and the heads. This could not continue. By October of 1852, planting season was upon the Amakhosa, so Chief Siolo decided to negotiate. He arrived at John McLean's headquarters at Fort Murray outside King Williamstown to talk, surrounded by an armed band. After discussing the situation with McLean and having handed over his musket to the British, Siolo believed he had arrived at an amicable solution. So McLean invited him into the fort for some tea, but as the chief stepped inside, he was seized. Siolo was sent to Grahamstown, where he was court-martialed on a charge of rebellion and sedition and sentenced to death. That was commuted to life in prison on Robben Island. Cathcart, meanwhile, went on to try to defeat Moshoeshoe, but was himself defeated at the Battle of Berea, something we discussed two episodes ago. Next episode, we'll hear how the 8th Frontier War ended in an old South African tradition, a peace that satisfied no one. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading an update about the series every couple of weeks. You can email me from there. Also, sign up for my little newsletter, please. Until next, salagatli. Thank you.